In Autobiography of a Yogi, there's a story about Lahiri Mahashaya finding his way up to Babaji, and then Babaji manifests in this completely barren wilderness a golden jewel-encrusted palace. And they tell the story of how it was a subconscious desire in Lahiri that Babaji fulfilled, and so they have the Kriya initiation in this extraordinarily lavish, beautiful place, and then Babaji just dematerializes it, and it just goes away, and they're back on the barren hillside again. I mean, it's just an amazing story. Swamiji talks more about it being that Lahiri was King Janaka in a previous incarnation. King Janaka was a very, very famous wealthy saint, sage. And so Babaji was reliving that incarnation. And then in Autobiography of a Yogi, it goes on to talk about the evanescent nature of all reality and how all molecules are just held together by our conscious will or by the will of God. And when we become masters of our own destiny, we can manifest and unmanifest with just this tremendous power. It's one of the many things in autobiography that either pushes you away or draws you in. You can kind of go both ways, or you might put it up on a shelf for a while. But it just speaks with such naturalness about this the extraordinary possibilities of our own consciousness, of which we are totally ignorant. And we walk around, you know, just in the tiny stories, trying to manifest a microphone that consistently works. You know, and just we struggle against the material plane, and we're always not sure how to use our energy. I remember once we had a meeting with Swami Kriyananda. We had many meetings with Swami over the course of 45 years of doing things. But one particular meeting, we started talking about building a temple. There was about maybe 8 or 9 of us in the room. And usually our conversation, Swamiji was very practical also. But this meeting, for some reason, we all just started talking about how beautiful a temple could be. And by the time we were finished, we had had an oval window at the top of this domed sphere, and we had crystals in the window, and we had gemstones so that this gem light could come down on people. And I don't know what happened exactly, but we had such a glorious time with our imagination. Very interestingly, for many years after, Swamiji referred to that as the best meeting we'd ever had. The best committee meeting, for sure, but just the best meeting. And he talked about it as being one of the few times when we actually allowed ourselves really to use the full power that was in us to see a reality that wasn't there, and visualize it with enough force that it created real magnetism. Now, I've contemplated that many, many, many times over the years, because I tend to be pretty grounded in the way I think about things. And I tend to sort of try to not bring up ideas that aren't too practical. And so much so that at one point, Swami Kriyananda said to me, "Well, you have a tendency to be negative." And I said, "Swamiji, I'm the soul of enthusiasm. How could I be negative?" And then he said it just like this. He said, "Well, you always feel an inclination to be so factual." He said it just like that, factual. I've always sort of heard it as a bit of a curse after that. But when I started thinking about it, I realized how little we perceive this world for what it really is, and how differently Swamiji always saw it. Swamiji always understood, and this is something that we're all learning, that this world is a flow of energy. This is what the physicists talk about. This is what Dwapara Yuga is. Dwapara Yuga is still a materialistic age. We think we're coming into a new age, and we're quickly being disillusioned. We've had this idea that everything was going to get so good so fast. He says it's just a more subtle level of materialism. Now we understand that the basic power behind matter is energy. And that's a step up from just thinking it was an inert form. And so now we're tuned into energy, so we're able to do all these things that we weren't able to do, just in terms of inventions and travel and communication. And I was reading a book about missionaries. It's a book about American saints. It's actually a very entertaining book. And some of the American saints became saints on the American soil, but it was in the 1700s, and they had come from Europe, and they were evangelists. They were missionaries from the established Christian world coming to convert the savages, which was the American Indians in this country. And this one poor woman came over here, and she was still trying to be under obedience to the mother of her order in France, except it took a year for letters to go back and forth. So she would send a letter with some problem she had, and then a year later she would get advice as to how to solve it. You can imagine it didn't work very well. Just because I'm talking about them, here's another just amazing way that the world works. The belief of these Catholic priests, some were Jesuits and some were Franciscans, is that unless you accept Jesus Christ, especially unless you receive the sacraments at the time of death, then you're going to end up in hell. And you know, it was a very seriously held belief. Whether you accept it or not, they accepted it. It was the age of Kali Yuga. It was matter. Everything was just fixed and solid. So these priests came over here, the black-robed ones, and they brought with them, of course, all of these diseases, which decimated the Native American population. And the Europeans were not subject to them. Flu, sometimes it was smallpox, but they brought the diseases in and then decimated the people. But then the priests were especially keen to go where the dying people were, because when they were dying, they could convert them, give them the sacraments, and they would be saved from going to hell. So now from the Indian point of view, they watch. First, these people come, then all this sickness comes, then these people rush out to the dying ones. They do all these mumbo-jumbo things, and from their point of view, over them, and then they die. The Indians draw a very reasonable conclusion that these black-robed people are killing our people. So they killed the priests. Simple, right? The priests became martyrs. Mamma mia. Other slight problems the priests ran into. In one of the native languages where they were teaching, they couldn't expect the Indians, they were Huron Indians, they couldn't expect them to learn French, so they had to learn Huron. The problem with explaining the theology is that there was no Indian word for sin, redemption, penance, because the concepts were just completely foreign. They couldn't understand. They were totally bewildered how anyone could be condemned to hell forever. How could God do such a thing? It just, and here these cultures are trying to meet. Just wildness. Wild things happen in the course of our lives. So anyway, but this is relevant. Here we are right now. We're in early Dwapara. It's still a materialistic age. And the materialism clashed, like here's the Catholic, here's the Native Americans, and they just smashed into each other like this, and nobody knew how to budge. Nobody could think about the underlying unity. It was just completely unthinkable. And now when we hear stories like I just told you, it feels barbaric to us. How could they not have seen each other's humanity? How could they not have understood that form is superficial, that energy is the true power? So bringing in this Dwapara age, we have this line of masters who are trying to explain to us that which we think is fixed is not really fixed at all. It's just a flow of energy. So in Autobiography of a Yogi, Lahiri finds himself in this desolate place, and he opens his eyes, and it's not a desolate place anymore. There's this golden palace. And Lahiri describes in Autobiography that he wandered from room to room and everything was beautifully furnished and there were these exquisite jewels on the walls and the architecture was perfect and Babaji was sitting on this golden throne and invited him. It's just playing with the material world. You know, we're working so hard to make every little piece of it. And they're trying to tell us, it's just a flow. It's just a flow of energy. Don't block the flow and you'll see what it'll work, what it'll be like. And Swamiji would come to us. I remember a meeting it was in the mid or late 80s. A lot was happening at Ananda Village at that point. It was before we were living here, so it would have been the early 80s, I think. And, you know, even to this day, there is not really an appropriate temple at Ananda Village. Although early in the 70s, there was a plan for one. But just somehow, time after time after time, that particular initiative was thwarted one way or another until just recently, this last summer, it was dedicated once again. We're going to get this temple built. But in the 80s, we had a minister's meeting, I believe, and Swamiji started the meeting with all of his energy, saying, now is the time. We really need a temple. We've had this community for so long, and we use this building or that building, but we need a temple that significantly expresses what it is that we're doing. And he was sort of getting us all ready. And then over lunch, people who had more facts told Swami about this that we owed money on and that which we were doing and this commitment and that commitment. And Swami came back to the group after lunch. Now this I know only in retrospect because I'm going through all my historical files and I have a transcript of this whole meeting, or at least I have notes of the meeting. Swamiji came back and he said, well, these objections have been raised. And he articulated them. He was very fair and he presented them. Reading it over, I realized what Swami wanted us to do was say, we can do it. And instead we said, oh yeah, that's all true, isn't it? And he just watched us just like a balloon, just let all of our capacity just drain out in the face of the facts. And of course, Swamiji was only one man. His power was enormous, but he had to draw people into the flow of energy. He was the prow of the ship, but he couldn't swim all by himself. There had to be somebody behind him. And if we could find that ray of energy that was his ray of energy, well, look at all of this. He was when he was 36, 1962, he was 36 years old. He was expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship. He'd been a monk for 14 years. He had absolutely nothing, nothing. He had no possessions, no money. He was separated from the only life he'd known for since he was 22 years old. He was forbidden to contact any of his friends. He did, fortunately, both his parents were living and lived comfortably. So he was able to stay in the guest room of their house, but he was alone in that guest room with no prospects. He had his guru and his devotion to his guru. Look at what Ananda is now. He did it from nothing. Nothing. And even though his parents were well-to-do, as he said quite emphatically, my father never gave me 10 cents for Ananda. Nothing. He just did it with that understanding that this world is energy. If I attune myself to the divine power, if I move according to what I feel the masters want me to do, it's just energy. It will conform to the power that we put forth. But if nobody came with him, he could write his own books. You know, he could speak his own understanding. He could sing his songs. But it was us that was needed. Because this is where the real power comes from. Every significant change throughout history has come from a small, dedicated group of people, and always, if it really had a lasting effect on history, it always was an inspiration from God, always. It's very interesting to read American history because the belief that that small group of people had that they could stand up to one of the most powerful countries in the world and they could wrest this valuable asset away from them and make into it a country, it had, the facts were against them, let's put it like that. Anybody who was too factual could never have done it. But the reason they could do it is they felt it from God. They knew that they had a destiny. And look at the role that America has played and does play. And look at the role that the masters give this country. This is the Dwapara Yuga country. All men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and happiness. Is it a total revolution? Well, it was a revolution, but it was a total revolution at the time. And no other country could have been the cradle for the message of self-realization, which again just wipes out all the ancient tradition, all the ancient prejudices, and says we are all created in the same way, with the same power, with the same potential, and you can realize it. And nothing can stop you. And even as Master said, in India, where they've known all their lives about the possibility of realizing God, everybody knows it's too hard and doesn't want to try. He says, in America, nobody knew. He could just say, let's realize God. And people said, sure. You know, why not? Today, we can do it. I was amazed the first time I left this country and went first to Europe. I didn't go to India till later. But I went to Italy, and I was amazed by the fact that the Florentines thought that Michelangelo had lived in their city, actually had something to do with them. You know, you have this ancient greatness. And when I went to India, I saw it was even bigger. You have this ancient greatness, and you walk around thinking that somehow this makes you something. Well, Americans, whatever our faults, and there, we have many faults, but one of our amazing things is we have so little history. You know, in business since 1995, it's like great big. It's like, so we have no history. So whatever reality we have to make it ourselves. We can't just ride on the glory of the past and say, I'm from Rome, I'm from Florence, I'm from Varanasi, my family has been pujaris here for 16 generations. We don't have any of that, none. I mean, we're getting a little after, 200 years? You know, we have a little bit. But it has to come out of us. This is Dwapara. This is what is possible. You know, manifest a golden palace. Babaji just did it so casually. And then when it was done, he just took it away, just like that. You know, this is what Swamiji slowly, steadily, through us, not alone, but through us, has taken us on this magnificent ride where we've just started with nothing. When we were starting our school, it was now 24 years ago, if I'm accurate in that, I remember sitting in the living room of our house, and we had a few of the potential parents there. And there was a kind of uncertainty in the room. And I couldn't figure out why there was this uncertainty in the room. And then I realized we were trying to get them to enroll their children, about whom they were somewhat protective, as you can imagine, their precious child. We wanted them to give their children to a school that had no faculty, no building, no money, and no history. And it only very slowly penetrated that these were obstacles. Because to me it was like, wow, what a better place to give your child than to something that doesn't exist yet. Because then we're going to be all part of manifesting it. And isn't that so much more fun than walking into some dull, already created, oh my God, centuries of tradition and all of this entrenched energy. So I remember saying to the parents, oh, I see the problem. You're looking at the spot in the carpet and you just see a spot on the carpet. You don't understand that when we look at the spot in the carpet, we see this school. Because we are children of Swami Kriyananda. I mean, I didn't say that to those parents, but that was the reason. We are children of Swami Kriyananda. We are heirs to Babaji. And if God wants it, it's just a matter of energy. And I know that's why Swami loved that meeting, because we just didn't bother to be factual. We understood that we have the power of the universe within us, and if we can imagine it, and if we apply enough directed, concentrated energy, we can achieve it. I remember very sweetly, very poignantly, there was a woman who had a serious cancer. And it was terminal. It took her life, although she lived longer than anyone expected her to. But at one point, as people do, she was becoming naturally rebellious against the mixed bag that is cancer treatment nowadays. It can definitely prolong your life, and it takes a certain toll. And so she didn't want to deal with that. So she was going to heal herself. And I remember Swamiji, I wasn't there actually, but this is what I was told. Swamiji just looked at her and said, "Do you have the concentration and willpower to do that?" It wasn't an accusation, it was just a question. "Do you have the concentration and willpower to do that?" Meaning, yes, of course this can be done, but do you have it to do it? She sort of sat for a minute and said, "No, sir," because she didn't. You know, it was a theory, but she didn't have that power. So there's always this line that we're always working with, and this is what Swamiji was always moving us, trying to move us beyond this. And that day when he said, "Let's build a temple," I believe if just one of us in the room that afternoon had said, "I think we can do it," I think we would have a temple at Ananda Village right now. Because I think it was there to happen, but just not even one of us could do it. You know, because there's just this, it's very subtle. Once you start working with energy, it gets very subtle. Now I'm bringing us all the way back to the Golden Palace, which is where I started. I didn't forget. I knew where we were. And this is what we talked about, those of you who were there last night, but it's important enough, I've devoted all this morning to it as well. As many of you know, a few miles down this road at 240 Monroe, Ananda has a community, and we've had that community there since 1989. It's a wonderful piece of land in this present, oh my God, real estate market that we're working in right now. That's one of the largest, like, semi-open contiguous pieces of property left on the peninsula. So its value has increased about fivefold from when we bought it, and it wasn't when it was purchased, not by us, and it wasn't cheap then. Okay? So for 27 years, we've had a community there. It's been great. We've had an absolutely fantastic time, but we've been renting it for 27 years. Do the math. That's a lot of money, and we're nowhere in it. It was purchased for the purpose of making community. The contract of the owner says it will always be a community. It cannot be sold out from under us until we relinquish it. But it's been run what's turned out to be an amazing positive investment for the people who own it, many of whom, most of whom, are our friends. It was purchased by our friends for this purpose. And it's been a marvelous relationship. As I was saying to people last night, we've supported a lot of Ananda enterprises over these 27 years by paying rent and by having the values increase and have the rent go up and all of this. But from the point of view of an Ananda community, it's not quite where it should be. And for many reasons, money is one of them, but that's only one of them. We have a responsibility here to set a new model, to show a different way of living, to show what we can do together. And honorable business is part of that model. But if we're going to have a community, we need to be able to have the community run on the values of the community. It's a for-profit business now. The community needs to be non-profit. It's as simple as that. But we're not the Soviet Russia, so we can't just nationalize the oil company from night to morning. We have a very simple system here. We either have to manifest a jewel-encrusted palace and sell the jewels, or we have to find some other way to convert that ownership. So after, many years on the part of some of us, and especially for me, very intensely in the last few months, I've just really felt that we can do it. And I don't know how fast, but I believe we can do it. And in fact, I'm pushing the limits of my own way of doing things. And we're friends here, I'm telling you. I've not usually been I've liked the facts. This time I'm not interested in the facts at all. I think we can do it because I think we must. We're not really doing this for ourselves. I mean, we're having a great time as we go along, but we're pioneers in a very important spiritual movement. You know, Master, we have a job to do. Master was commissioned by Babaji. Swami was commissioned by Master. And we were commissioned by Swamiji. And we have a job to do. And we need to leave a legacy behind us that is so deeply rooted and so clearly created that it will carry on for generations to come. That's what we did when we bought this temple, a gift to God and gurus now and for generations to come. And now we have to start on the community. So we thought Babaji's Golden Palace was a very good affirmation, because I think the assessed value of our property and it are probably really, really close. So he seemed like the right guy who could do this for us. Yukteswar didn't even want a new rug, you know, so we're not going with him. He's the wrong man for Silicon Valley. Babaji's our guy. Last night we had a marvelous ceremony, and we rededicated. When Swami came in 1990 and dedicated that community, he said it was Babaji's community. Last night we gave it to him again. We've gotten a little distracted. So we put this Golden Palace up here, and those of you who helped us go through, I'll take the whole pile. Those of us who helped us go through paying off the mortgage on this property, remember that we had a puzzle up there. And every time we raised $25,000, we put another piece in the puzzle until we had it all. Well, we have a jewel-encrusted palace with not many jewels on it. So as God and Babaji and each of us gradually convert this community into a gift to God and gurus for generations of truth seekers now and forever, we'll add jewels to the Golden Palace. So it's going to be up there for a while. And we also printed up these little cards, which I'm going to put up on the altar, and you all can pick them up later. This is dedicating our community to Babaji and asking his grace. It says, "You who manifested a golden palace in the Himalayas, manifest here a perfect world brotherhood colony." I didn't actually intend to spend the whole sermon talking about this, but I guess it needed to be said. So I invite you to move a little above the obvious. You know, this community together has shown a tremendous capacity to manifest. Look around. And I see no reason why we can't finish. You know, this is a very important, we're not done. And we have one more marvelous thing to do for Master. And won't it be a joy when it's done? God bless.